General Gordon Sullivan, U.S. Army retired as president and CEO of the Association of the U.S. Army, writing in the Hill newspaper under the title Losing Faith Because of Budget Impasses. General, you write, lasting scars to our nation's national security are forming because of the continued political stalemate over spending priorities, including our financial commitment. Sir, do you believe that it's because of the back and forth political nature of deciding on a budget at all, or is it the numbers because of budget reductions and sequestration, or both? Thanks for your time today, General.
Francis, I think it's because of both, and it's the consistency of the discussion that's drug on since sequestration, which wasn't supposed to happen, did happen, and it continues. As a matter of fact, it continues until this very day. We just can't seem to come together in the government to publish a budget and to acknowledge the demands of security, the demands of our national security, and that's troublesome to me.
You served as the 32nd Chief of Staff of the Army. What has changed in your view as far as how the political operation regards the military and serves the military budget-wise and rhetoric-wise since you served as Chief of Staff, sir?
I served from 1991 to 1995. It was a period of transition from the Cold War into this world in which we live now, some of which was probably not predictable, but what was predictable was that we were getting smaller, and that was pretty well decided in the late 80s, and certainly in my case, we were executing that drawdown and transformation of the Army. And that was all pretty predictable. Also, the budgets and the programs were reasonably predictable. There was a change between the first Bush, Bush Senior 41, and President Clinton. There was a change, but it was all arithmetic, and it wasn't quite as disruptive as what's going on now. So I don't think there's much comparison, really. It's different. The deficits and sequestration resulting from that, and now this, what I view as inability for the government to come together in a bipartisan way.
You write, there are consequences from leaving the military adrift and undirected, not the least of which is a sense of unease bordering on irrelevance among the good, honest people who have dedicated themselves to military service. What are some of the other consequences that concern you as someone with the level of experience and service that you had, sir?
First of all, the numbers are unclear in categories: R&D, acquisition, personnel, and so forth. And we're still sending people off to war. I mean, it's should be fairly obvious to everyone when the services have people in Afghanistan, maybe more in Iraq, more advisors or whatever, in both countries, and the Air Force and the Navy, Marines are out in various places, which might be called dangerous, certainly by them it would be, that we just treat it as if it's a benign world and nothing is going on. And I'm sure they're beginning to wonder what is happening in our government that can't quite come together. And why is that the case? And I don't think it's good.
General Gordon Sullivan, U.S. Army retired, was the 32nd Chief of Staff of the United States Army, is now President and CEO of the Association of the U.S. Army, and writing in the Hill newspaper. And you write that it is not just the men and women in uniform and the civilians that support them. You write, our defense industry, which stood by us through a decade of war, is increasingly reluctant to consider doing military work when a slowly improving economy offers alternatives that appear to be more stable. All the conversations that I have, sir, support exactly what you've written. And on top of that, I've discussed on this program many times the fact that companies that may have new technologies to offer the military are reluctant to get into the business of doing with the military. What are the roadblocks beyond the political stalemate, if any, or is that the major one to both keeping the defense industrial base companies that we need in the defense industrial base and bringing new companies in, sir?
Well, I think the obvious roadblock is, even if we could come together and publish a budget with, let's say, even if sequestration were to go away, the budget would be constrained somewhat, I predict, by the reality of the deficit. I don't think we would go into a budget surplus mode for years to come unless we come to grips with it. So I'm not sure we will come out of this soon, but certainly a start would be if the government could come together and eliminate sequestration and start us on the road into this utopian world, I suppose some of your listeners would say, where we actually all did get along and could come to grips with our problems in a collaborative way.
This is not just an internal or an issue on the home front either, sir. You're right, on the world stage, our friends, allies, and even potential adversaries are unsure the direction we're headed because the U.S. doesn't speak with one voice on foreign policy and has no budgetary roadmap that would show our commitment. And maybe I would add to that statement your thoughts on the wide variety of planning and policy documents that we have, too, some of which appear, at least, to go in different directions.
Yeah, well, we present, it's the same face, but it's that face is being seen two different ways. Our enemies see it as, they don't know what they're going to do anyway, so I'm just going to do what we had planned. And I think we're seeing some of that, where our enemies are willing to take risks that they normally wouldn't take, because we're acting in a way that is different. And our friends, I think, so this is the other face, our friends are beginning to ask, and you can see it in the overseas press and even in articles in the United States, where they're saying, well, wait a minute, where is the U.S.? Will the U.S. respond to an Article 5 incursion into the Baltics, into NATO nations, and either there or down in Hungary or Poland, I mean, or elsewhere, by the Russians? Where are they on these issues? Where is the U.S. on these issues? And I think the Japanese were asking it for a while, which is why Japanese and Koreans, why the president visited and so forth and so on.